There is an event that I have to tell you about. It is one that I have attended 3 times in a row, and that is the NEO Summit. Y'all, it is honestly unlike any nonprofit event experience I have ever seen. This year, it will take place on September 18th and 19th in Indianapolis, Indiana. It is 2 full days of digital marketing and fundraising content, workshops, over-the-top fun summit parties, prizes, swag, and so much more. Dare I say, it is a masterclass in edutainment. They have truly mastered the balance between learning and having a really great time. Now, I have worked with them on getting you the lowest price ticket available anywhere. You can save $600 on your ticket by using my link in the show notes. Hope to see you there. Now let's head on over to today's episode.
We were really serious about digital activism from day one. We were a digital first organization. We never really had a physical location. People have been hired all over the place. And so when the pandemic rolled around, we were really ready. And that's really been wonderful for us. Like in our entire existence, we've only had 2 quote unquote galas, both really successful and wonderful. But we're a digital organization. We're building a grassroots base of Americans who are bought in on this problem and really want to be Americans, helping Americans close this gap for good.
Hey there, you're listening to the Missions to Movements podcast, and I'm your host, Dana Snyder, digital strategist for nonprofits and founder and CEO of Positive Equation. This show highlights the digital strategies of organizations making a positive impact in the world. Ready to learn the latest trends, actionable tips, and the real stories from behind the feed? Let's transform your mission into a movement. Hey, all. Welcome back to another episode of the Missions to Movements podcast. This is a really special episode today. A fellow Los Angeles friend is joining me, George McCraw. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I love it when I get to talk with somebody across the coast and reminisce about Los Angeles days. How are things over there today?
They're a little unusually cloudy today. And you know, in LA, when you get used to those sunny mornings, you wake up and it's cloudy and you feel like, what? I can't even get out of bed. Like I have no energy. Yeah. What is happening? I take it so for granted. How's everything in Atlanta? Are you missing it?
It's humid. I just got back from an amazing trip in Portland, though, which I will say is gorgeous. So I was able to get some West Coast vibes into my system. And I'm really excited to talk with you because you have built a beautiful mission and beautiful brand surrounding your organization, which I think is really important. And I read a stat that's pretty profound on your website, and that's that 2.2 million Americans are without sinks, bathtubs, toilets, water essential, right? It seems so difficult to fathom that this is something that we're still dealing with here. And I think a lot of times, right, we think of the third world countries, but we don't think about necessarily our own personal need for a basic necessity like that. How did you find yourself leading the mission through Dig Deep to really close the water gap within the states?
I mean, first of all, you're right. We don't tend to think of it. I mean, this is the richest democracy on earth, and you just think these things are taken care of. And those 2.2 million, by the way, those are people who have no running water at all at home. So folks in places like Flint who maybe have plumbing, but the water isn't safe to drink, like that's maybe 40 or 50 million more people that are facing these challenges. We ask this question all the time, I know. And I think a really common answer to this question is like, I don't know, how did I get here? Because at some point you look back on your professional, your career, and you're like, what the hell? I've always been obsessed with water, but I thought if you wanted to work on this issue, you had to work abroad in other countries. And in fact, digdeep.org, the organization that I run, our first projects were in Cameroon and in South Sudan. And we did this work in low-income countries. And it wasn't until, oh gosh, it must have been 6 or 7 years ago now that I got a call from a donor who was like, I want to give you $50, but you have to spend it in the US.
And interesting.
I was like, Karen, her name was, I kid you not, Karen. And she's like, Karen, why don't you let me spend your money where like people really need it? And she's like, you are a I probably shouldn't say it, but she was like, come on, like, you don't know this is a problem in your own country. What's wrong with you? And to her credit, she had been building houses on like a Habitat for Humanity style project in the Southwest on the Navajo Nation, which is the country's largest reservation. And they were building houses without kitchens and bathrooms. And she turned to her Navajo colleagues and said, what is going on? They were like, well, there's no running water in this community, so we can't build those things.
Oh my gosh.
And so she went down the list of organizations trying to get someone to help her, and finally got to us, and we were so small. I mean, I would do anything for $50, you know, a decade ago. So I was like, great, let's find out about this. And that led to a journey that brought our work back home. And now we're the main organization focused on solving that problem.
Wow. Are you completely just US states focused now versus abroad, or do you do both?
Just US focused. I think it took us a couple of years to find the right partners and to build the right capacity locally to hand our international projects over to those communities and make sure they would still continue. And, you know, we had a long tail for sustainability, but there wasn't a single other WASH, water, hygiene, and sanitation organization working in the US at the time.
Wow. What year was this?
This was 2016. We finally made the transition fully, but I think we started working on the issue in the US in 2013 when I got that call from Karen.
Oh my gosh, that's fascinating. Was there this disbelief when you decided to do the switch?
I mean, I still encounter that disbelief 3 times a week. I was just getting my eyes checked at an optometrist on Friday, and my optometrist was like, what? What? That can't be right. There's no way. The even crazier thing is it's 2.2 million Americans and growing. You know, every year we're adding more to that number rather than subtracting. So in most other countries, the work of organizations like Charity Water, which I know you've had on before, and I don't know, Concern International and USAID, and those efforts are grinding those numbers down in other countries where ironically it's increasing here.
Jeez. Yeah, that's something that you don't even think about on a day-to-day basis. And I wanted to ask you too, your organization has been around for, is it 11 going on 12 years?
I started working on this. I mean, you couldn't call it an organization at the time, but in 2011, and we formally incorporated in 2012. So we're about at the 10-year mark.
Congratulations. Happy almost birthday whenever that anniversary hits.
Thank you. Yeah, it feels like we have an adolescent on our hands.
Yes, yes. For listeners that are, oh man, maybe at all different phases of their fundraising journey, how have you really seen your fundraising efforts and strategies really evolve from the early days to maybe like a couple years in to now?
I'm not sure you could call the early days a strategy.
I love that.
You know, the strategy is to survive and whatever it takes. That's the like, yes, Karen, I will get in your car with you and drive 10 hours to take that $50. But I think we're lucky because the organization has always, we're a human rights organization, right? We don't call ourselves a charity. What we do isn't charitable work. Every person, certainly every American that we interact with, has a human right to the basic things they need to live and live with dignity. And in this country, hot and cold running water in your home and in your school and in your community is one of those things. And so what we do isn't just like nice because it helps people get something. It's correcting an injustice. And we take that same human rights approach to everything we do. And we did it really early on because many of us worked in human rights. And so really the core of what we do is kind of a nothing about them without them approach. And that has meant that now that we're almost 80 employees, 40% of us come from the communities that we serve. 44% of us have lived without running water ourselves, or some currently live without it. It means that all of our managers and directors are from those communities that we serve. It also means that on the client side, like those communities really participate with us in developing the projects that bring them hot and cold running water and flush toilets and the things that we build. And I think that's even true on the fundraising, marketing, and storytelling side, which has really been about from the early days, interacting, engaging with these clients and empowering them to tell their own stories and not just devolving into this sort of like poverty pornography of it all. And instead, using our marketing and fundraising work to correct the problem, not just to raise money. If the problem is that these communities in places like Native reservations and border communities and Appalachia and the rural South, if the problem has been that those folks have lacked agency and visibility, that they weren't being involved in decision making, that they weren't being funded, that they weren't being seen, then why not kill two birds with one stone, empower them to tell their own stories in ways that feel additive, not extractive, and empowering and authentic and personal and beautiful, and use that not only to raise money, which is super important because that powers everything, but also to boost awareness of the problem and the solutions that are really capable of ending it.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point. When you are in those markets, how do you approach those individuals in telling their stories in a way that doesn't seem like, oh, this is like for our benefit, even though it's helping them, right? But it's letting them tell their own stories. How do you approach that conversation?
You know, I rarely approach the conversation myself, and few people from LA would. I think it's mostly our local project field staff that are identifying these folks and interacting with them and helping them tell their story and understand where that story is going to go and how it's going to be used, and making sure once it does get used and goes somewhere to a press outlet or to a video of ours, that all of that content makes it back into the hands of the person that helped generate it. So there's like a closed loop, you know, something that feels complete. I think that's super important. And it has been, I think, a key to our success. People take for granted that like the US is one country, but it's not really. You know, like the way our clients approach their lives and their communities and even solving this problem on the Navajo Nation, for instance, is completely different than it is on our Appalachia Water Project in rural West Virginia or on our Colonias Water Project in rural Texas. And I think to have really like kind, transparent, culturally competent conversations about storytelling, there is no substitute for being from that community. And so that's why we have a big, diverse staff.
That's amazing. And your staff and the culture that you've built, how have you worked to really instill a positive culture within? So the team, I'm assuming, are they remote all over the place?
Yeah, I think we're in like 8 or 9 states as an organization. And some people, you know, they do show up to an office every day. I show up to our office in Los Angeles a few days a week, but there are folks that show up to an office in the morning because they're out plumbing people's houses or driving water trucks or doing engineering work. So it's a mix of sort of digital and in-person across the organization. As far as how that culture was built, I think it's a little alchemy, a little magic to it. But really, I think it was a few first champions who asked tough questions and made sure that as they were given power in the organization, they used it for good. I remember like when we started the organization, like in so many cases, you start building an organization, you start employing people, and maybe you can't afford to do everything you want to, like provide medical insurance, for instance. But we got to this point where the executive director of our Navajo Water Project, this really incredible Diné artist and activist, Emma Robbins, it was just 3 of us in the organization at the time, but we were starting to hire on the reservation where she was from. And she said, you know, we've been thinking of this, like the folks we're hiring, they have healthcare through the Indian Health Service, through the federal government. But the healthcare is in many cases poor quality and people aren't going to access it. And so we were talking about, okay, let's get health insurance as a company and maybe we can cover 20% of the cost or 30% of the cost. And then the employees will cover the rest to get started. And she said, I don't think so. Like we really have to stretch and cover 100% of it, because if we don't, then a whole class of our employees that maybe have access to the Indian Health Service, they'll think, well, I don't want to spend that chunk of my paycheck buying additional medical service. But then when they really need it, the level of care won't be there. They need that private insurance. And so we have to look at that structural inequity in the organization. We have to correct for it right from the beginning and make sure that no matter where you live, we're offering 100% employer paid. Because if we don't, we're going to end up with a situation where people in cities, they pay for it, and people in rural areas or with additional services from the government, for instance, don't. And then there's going to be a difference in the way people experience healthcare in the organization. And so like that was such a moment for me of, holy shit, I didn't see that. She was able to see it, not only see it, but see it in advance. You know, it hadn't even come to pass yet. And that was such a powerful experience for me and so representative of many of the conversations that have happened over the last decade.
Yeah, to have all those different perspectives is so important. And it's interesting, right? I mean, as an entrepreneur, sometimes when you're starting out small, you have to start and you're bringing on team members. It's like, oh, I need to start to think about retirement benefits and healthcare benefits and doing the research about those things, which is the so like not sexy part of trying to like get to your, I'm just trying to focus on my mission. But obviously you need people to be able to amplify and do the impact of the work and to get good people and to support them. And that's what's led to building this amazing culture of the 80 some odd people that you said have been in your organization. When did you start to really hire any digital marketing team members?
You know, I think to your point that you just made, I think the irony of that, of course, is that it pushes you as a founder further and further from the work on the ground in many cases, but often because there are people who are much better than you at what you do. We do have like a really incredible digital presence, and we've really looked up to some other brands that have done incredible work, Charity Water, chief among them. And, you know, I'm friends with Scott Harrison and Christoph, their CEO, and they've been so incredible about, sometimes I'll come to the office in New York and sit down with their like events or marketing people and just harvest ideas and get guidance. And they're really, I think, an inspiration as an organization too, because they've made mistakes and they have pioneered so many digital innovations and then retooled and restructured and refocused as issues around like equity and impact have come to light. And I think they've been really transparent about that process. And that's been a real fun thing to watch. But I'm dancing around your question. I think we were really serious about digital activism from day one. We were a digital first organization. We never really had a physical location. People have been hired all over the place. And so when the pandemic rolled around, we were really ready. And that's really been wonderful for us. Like in our entire existence, we've only had two quote unquote galas, both really successful and wonderful. But we're a digital organization. We're building a grassroots base of Americans who are bought in on this problem and really want to be Americans helping Americans close this gap for good. And the problem, unfortunately, isn't local. You know, it's in all 50 states. It's in urban and rural areas. I think if you're going to try to build an in-person ground game as an organization, you have to have a much more focused mission that's tied to a place, and ours isn't.
Publishing social media content manually is a hassle. And having one place to view all of your analytics is truly a game changer for easy reporting. And the best part is I have a free option for you. Later is the leading visual social media marketing platform for Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and TikTok. So you can plan, you can analyze, and publish content, including reels, using Later. Two of my favorite features are that you can search for user-generated content with hashtags and know your unique best time to post so you can schedule in batches. There are a bunch of other cool features, but again, the best part is there's a free account option. So go ahead and sign up, get your free account, stop doing all the hustle posting manually. Go to try.later.com/positive equation. That's try.later.com/positive equation. Within the digital team, when you were hiring, were you looking for certain qualifications?
Now we are. Now we can afford to look for certain qualifications and experience. I think at the beginning, no. And so much of it at the beginning was about how to develop skills on the team. I mean, I have been our acting creative director for the last decade, but I studied law and I've worked with a number of really smart people, pro bono and consultants over the years, graphic designers and videographers and copywriters. But most of the copy and graphic design and photo treatments and font systems and all that sort of stuff, like I've developed and I taught myself Photoshop and Illustrator and the whole Adobe suite over the course of this, because it was like, we have to put all this money into program. Of course, we can't afford design. But I do think that we got lucky, both in my curiosity around that and in some of the people that came to assist when they saw what we were trying to do. And now, if I could do it over, I think I would have done it a little differently. I would have invested a little more in that infrastructure up front, because it's paid such incredible dividends. I think having a really strong brand identity and digital presence has allowed us to punch above our weight for a long time.
Yes, I think it's everything, especially in the world that we're living in today. I mean, honestly, not even today. I kind of take that back. Strong brand presence, for-profit, nonprofit, whatever, has always led to being memorable and more known and more visible. It adds to credibility. I speak to this a lot of times with websites. If I go to a website that's looking like a hot mess, I'm like, is this organization, are they like legit?
Are they also a hot mess?
Yeah. Exactly. Are they also a hot mess? Like if I can't figure out how to give, or if things are looking a little wonky, or if it's like a platform that doesn't really exist anymore. Yeah. You start to have questions. I'm like, I don't know if I should put my money here.
It's really interesting the impact that that has on your service provision too. And it's been good and bad for us. Our earliest project was on the Navajo Nation. It's called the Navajo Water Project. It's now more than half of our budget. Our other projects in other regions are growing, but it's still sort of the heart of our work. And since the beginning, having that brand presence on the reservation where a lot of stuff passes through Facebook and word of mouth has been really powerful because it's created this inbound flow of clients who say, like, here's my community without running water, or here's my issue, or I heard about you on this Facebook group and I need this service or I need this help. And that's been really powerful because one of the critical problems with water and sanitation access in the US is a lack of actionable data. Census is no longer keeping data on who has and who doesn't have running water. In fact, in 2016, we removed one of the last questions from the census that just asked, does your house have a flush toilet? And so as the data gets worse and worse, like, we need inbound information in order to help plan our projects and grow our impact and know what people are experiencing and where they're experiencing it and what that deficiency is so we can correct it. And if we didn't have a strong brand presence that was recognizable and Googleable and instilled trust, like, I don't think we would have that, but it is a double-sided coin. So I don't know if I've ever talked about this publicly. One of the most powerful projects I think we've ever done was to bring running water to a special needs school on the Navajo Nation called St. Michael's Association for Special Education. And we approached it like so many of our projects. Like, there's this incredible school with a couple hundred students ranging from kindergarten or pre-K, I think, all the way up to adults, some living on campus, some not. The place doesn't have running water, or it had running water, but it was too contaminated to use. And so they didn't. They used bottled water for cooking and cleaning and bathing the students and cleaning out their tracheotomy tubes. And we're talking people with really intense medical and developmental disabilities who need a high level of service and have no way of fighting for themselves or representing themselves in this situation. And so we did what we often do, which is like, well, let's blow this thing up. Let's give this community the chance to tell their own story, and let's put them in front of the press, and let's build a beautiful website, and let's do videography and work with native creators. And we did. And we forgot a really critical piece of this puzzle, which is that we didn't have control when we talked to press about the project. We didn't have control of how it would be expressed in the end. It's a free press. And so we got into these interviews and talked about how Navajo Nation is doing their best. And it's an incredible set of engineers and technicians and hydrologists working to solve this problem, but they have no resources and they have no... But of course, in the press, everything is just essentialized. And so it's just like, can you believe that this special needs school is allowed to exist this way? And like, whose fault is this? And I think that was really successful at raising us funds, right? People flooded to the website. We did this partnership with Michael Phelps. Like, it was incredible. And we were able to do that project. But at the very beginning, I think we were getting calls from people working in Navajo Nation government, in the Department of Water Resources, and with engineers, and saying like, hey, like, you guys are blowing up this project. It's making everyone look bad. It's making us look like we don't care. Like, we haven't been working on this day and night for our entire careers. And it really damaged our relationship with some of the most important people working on this issue across the reservation. And I think it was a huge learning curve for us that, like, a strong brand and a strong marketing presence can be a powerful fundraising engine. It can be a powerful engine for program growth. But if you're not careful about controlling that message and making sure that it's truly inclusive and empowering and honest and transparent, you risk alienating allies that without whom you can't do the work. And so we had to really engage with those folks and reconcile with them and apologize to them and change the way we approach press. And now every time we work with a member of the press, they get like a kit before that's like, here are the words you're allowed to use. Here are the words you're not allowed to use. Here's what we, you know, and here's how you approach the problem. And don't forget to talk about these things, because I think that's the lesson.
That's a really good point. So I used to work for a PR firm, and sometimes they'll let you read the article beforehand to be able to fact check, but you don't know what you don't know, right? You just think, oh, great, this amazing newspaper said they're going to write something about us. Like, awesome. And you don't think twice about it. But exactly what you're saying, to be able to send those kits, to be able to send those boilerplates, and having good relationships with the media so that they understand this is the goal of what we're trying to achieve. Are we all on the same page about how we want this to come across? I think that's such a good mini case study in what you just shared. So thank you for being open to share that story, because I think there's probably a ton of organizations that can resonate with exactly what you just said, or wouldn't even think about checking to make sure that something's going to come across in the light that you want it to be.
Yeah. One last thing I'll add there is that one of the lessons that we learned there and sort of implementing on all of our promotional campaigns is, like many organizations, you have limited resources, you're focused on the biggest bang for your buck. And so we'd often try to push national press or press in markets where we knew there were a lot of donors. Now we don't push a campaign that doesn't go both to the local market where the project is and to national regional markets, because we were realizing that like that model can be so extractive, no matter who's telling the story, even if it's a client or a staff member of ours from that community. If that story is not getting retold inside the community where it's coming from, there's no accountability. And someone can't come to you and correct you or offer additional perspective. And so that's something we really push for now too, is like, you can't just place it with CNN and the Washington Post. It also has to be in an Appalachian Tribune. It also has to be in the Navajo Times. It's got to be where the work is.
This is a sidebar to this, but kind of the sensationalism that comes with a national news outlet. So I used to live in Florida where there's hurricanes all the time, right? If you were to watch the national news channels, it was going to be crazy and everything's out and there's mass panic and da 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 da. And then you go to like our local, it's like, everyone's doing great. Everyone's moving up. Or it was literally polar opposite. So when it came to getting updates on what was happening with the, we always watched the local news. I would go outside, like, there is no chaos. Like, where are you getting this one photo that would like, be like, this is what the entire city is dealing with. And I was like, that is one tiny little. Anyways, it's just interesting because the perspectives can also vary drastically. I want to switch gears a second. And I absolutely loved your 4 leaders challenge. I think the concept is really fun. And I got down the rabbit hole of watching some of the videos. Can you break down, A, what was it? What was the goal for it? What was the outcome? And for listeners, I'm going to link in the show notes to the website because it's still live so that you can see some of the content that we're talking about. But yeah, if you can break down like what it was all about, the goal, and then what happened, that would be awesome.
Sure. Well, what it's all about is that you have this dichotomy in the US. You have 99% of people who use 100 gallons of water or more a day have no connection to the resource, don't know what it is to love their water, right? They've never needed to. And then you have the less than 1% of people and growing who don't have access to water at all, but ironically know how valuable it is and have a deep relationship to it. And, you know, when we put running water in someone's house, you'd expect to see their consumption go from 0 to 60 overnight. But in fact, it stays really constant and really low because they're so used to conserving it and the relationship is so deep. So we're like, okay, how do we get, we're taking resources from this one group, this 99%, and we're investing it in solutions for this other group. How do we take their resource, which is knowledge and passion and connection to water, and export that, you know, create a relationship that is two-way? And the 4 Leaders Challenge was born. The idea is that most of us live on 100 gallons of water more a day. Most of our clients live off of less than a gallon or about 4 liters, which is also...
blows my mind.
Yeah, it's the minimum amount of water you need to survive a day. You need 2 or 3 liters to drink, to just to replace the water you're losing through exercise and burning your calories. And then you need another liter or two to wash your hands and prepare some food. And that's literally the survival minimum. You can't live on that for long and not get sick. And so the idea came from a board member of ours early on who was like, hey, I'm trying to connect with this issue. I live in New York and I've never lived without running water. And I want to get my kids and my wife and our family involved in this. And a week is intense. Let me tell you. I mean, it's intense to live this way. That's the whole point. So now it's shortened to just 24 hours. You grab a 1 liter bottle or you can grab a gallon milk jug or whatever it is. And for 24 hours, every drop of water you use comes from that container. If you're going to brush your teeth, if you're going to make some ramen, if you're going to wash your armpits, if you're going to clean that stain off your shirt, like it's got to come from that water. And then at 4 p.m. that day, you check in on social media using the hashtag 4 liters and you say like, okay, what's the day been like so far? What has surprised you? How much water do you have left to make it through the rest of the night? And really what happens is you bend psychologically. You start to plan your day around how much water you have, which is what these 2.2 million Americans do every day. They wake up in the morning and the first thought on their mind isn't like, oh my God, I have that presentation at work, or how am I going to run my kids' carpool? Or like, it's how am I going to get enough clean water to get myself and my family through the day? And what does that mean about the decisions I have to make on how I can exercise or how much time I can spend or how much money I can spend? And this just gives you a little window into that. But in my experience, it's enough to like start that shift. And after just 24 hours doing that, you start to, you like hear the water running in the other room the next day and you're like, ah, turn it off.
That's amazing. So is this a continuous campaign or was this for a couple months or a year or how did it work?
It's a continuous campaign. It's still live now. It's been really interesting. Like companies do it, companies that get involved in water or that have corporate CSR ESG programs, like their teams will do it internally. There was a team at Ralph Lauren who did it a couple of years ago. There are people doing it constantly. There are classrooms that do it as part of their, you know, social studies or sometimes social justice classes. And then a bunch of individuals who just like pick it up. We've had some like influencers and celebrities do it. And some of the videos and stuff people have posted are amazing. If you search the hashtag 4 leaders, you can usually find some new stuff on Instagram or Twitter. And so it really has had a life of its own, which has been awesome. But I want to take a minute, hopefully early next year, and really push this out through a marketing campaign and get people reinvested.
I love it because I think exactly what your board member was talking about. If you live a life where you do not have to worry about having clean water for your daily activities, it's so hard to fathom. And so to put yourself in the position where you're literally holding that leader and you can like mark it off at the levels and the times of where you're at. I mean, it's just such a powerful visual perspective. So I love that concept. Everybody go check it out. Click the link in the show notes, or you can go to their website. It's literally digdeep.org/4leaders, 4 with just the number 4. Amazing. So I want to jump into 2 final sections of our conversation. And George, one is called We Must Know. So we must know, which social media or digital platform are you most intrigued by right now?
Okay, so I thought about my answer to this question and it sounds so lame, but I'm intrigued by Instagram, not because of what Instagram is. It's certainly not new, but I think you have all these new platforms coming out that feel more instantaneous, more contemporaneous, like TikTok, like Be Real. And I'm a good millennial, so Instagram, I think, is my, you know, the mainstay of my social media. I'm not even on Facebook. And it's been really interesting to see the way those new platforms have influenced Instagram. Instead of people just leaving Instagram for those platforms, it's really changed the way they use it. And my feed feels so much less curated. It feels, I mean, feed, like I don't even look at my feed. I'm just looking at stories. And so I've really been enjoying that. And I love a good meme roundup account.
Yes, I love that. Yeah. And Instagram, yes, is learning from all the other platforms to stay as relevant as possible. Absolutely. On, maybe it is Instagram. Do you have a must follow account?
Oh my gosh. One that I can say out loud to all of your followers.
You can say whatever you would like to say.
Yeah, I am going to say it. So, you know, I love a meme roundup account. There is one that is sort of like, I have no idea who runs it, but it's sort of like a, maybe like a disaffected young woman in like modern dating and romance culture online in, I think, LA or New York. And her account is called Bimbo Fairy. And I have never laughed so hard as when I scroll through one of her things. And it's definitely not safe for work and very funny. And I think true to life. So take that for what it's worth.
I love it. Hey, we all need our humor in life. Right? I mean, I'm a fan of some memes too. So awesome.
I mean, and if she ever does anything wrong and gets canceled, you know, don't remember I ever said that. I was never a fan.
The guy was not there. Lastly is ask and receive. So this is where I like to ask you one thing that you would like to ask for help or support on from the listeners.
We are on the hunt at Dig Deep for our first creative director. I mentioned that. Ooh. I've been doing this work for like the last 10 years, but we're growing our
very
team.
Very exciting.
Yeah, it is. I think it goes along with the beginning of our conversation about how your job evolves and changes. Like I had capacity, curiosity, energy to sort of stay more on the cutting edge of branding, especially in the nonprofit world and pushing us forward with a digital strategy and all that sort of stuff. But you know, I'm the CEO of a company with, you know, almost 80 employees and I've lost my edge, man. You know, like I'm not there anymore and we need some really incredible talent really focused on creating a cohesive, powerful message across all of our platforms and audiences and taking that approach, having that, asking those questions in every one of our conversations. Like, is this consistent? Is this for the right audience? Like, is this on the right platform? Is it driving the right results? And so we're looking for someone like a creative that can both lead content production and get involved in like the messaging and the storytelling, but can also maybe do some of that work themselves. Maybe they have a background in graphic design or advertising or video production. So it's a little bit of a unicorn. We're hunting for it. If you or your friends know someone who's just, send them to us.
You heard it here.
You can find our open jobs at digdeep.org.
Perfect. Digdeep.org. Find out for the creative director role. It sounds so exciting and like an amazing project and program to be a part of. So George, where can people find you? Where can they connect with you?
You can connect with me at digdeep.org. You can also connect with me on social media. I'm on Instagram and Twitter and LinkedIn, if you're a real geek like I am, @@GeorgeMcGraw.
Perfect. I love my LinkedIn. Awesome. George, thank you so much for being here and the work that you do. And I am just fascinated to see how maybe even the creative branding shifts coming into the new year. So we'll be watching.
You and me both. Water's life. Thanks, Dana.
You got it.
Can you tell I love talking all things digital? To make this show better, I'd be so grateful for your feedback. Leave a review, take a screenshot of this episode, share it on Instagram stories, and tag Positive Equation with one E so I can reshare and connect with you.